mean, 5 minutes left, is that? I don't mind, I swear to God. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim wa salatu wa salamu ala Sayyidina Muhammad wa ala alihi wa sahbihi wa salam tasliman kathira wa la hawla wa la quwwata illa billah al-Ali al-Azim. Alhamdulillah. First of all, it's always amazing for me to see all of the youth that we have in this community. We have all over the United States, and those of us who travel around the United States, we see this. And it's very inspiring because I see so much dignity in our young Muslims in a time when human dignity is being challenged, just the whole concept of karama. What we're seeing everywhere is the degradation of culture. Culture is being degraded. If anybody knows, one of my favorite playwrights is George Bernard Shaw. He wrote a play called Pygmalion. And in that play, he has a character who's the father of Eliza Doolittle. And this character is basically, he's a rogue, he's outrageous. He comes to try to make some money off the fact that his daughter, he finds out, is in the house of a gentleman, which at that time, in that period in England, was considered scandalous. But he tries to make some money out of it. And the character in the play, Higgins, who's her teacher, elocution teacher, says, "Don't you have any morals?" And he says, "I can't afford them, Governor." In other words, I'm too poor to have morals. But the play, as it goes on, Higgins writes to a ethicist in America and mentions that the greatest moral ethicist that he's met is this character, Doolittle. And so he puts him in his will, and he ends up inheriting all this money. And he said, "It's very unfortunate because you've made me a gentleman. In other words, you forced me to be good." And even though he's mocking all of these bourgeois values in the play, there was a time when poor people aspired to be like the educated people. They wanted to be gentlemen. They tried to speak proper English. Many, many characters in literature are actually parodies of this idea of people aspiring to be educated or appear educated. What's happened now is the inversion of this aspect. You actually have people now that pretend to be poor. We have middle class youth now that actually pretend to be homeless in this culture. Really, they go out, it's kind of a trend to go out and they wear rags. You buy jeans now with holes in them, and you pay more money for good jeans. People, when I was growing up, the people that had tattoos, there was only three possibilities to have a tattoo. You were a prostitute, you were in a gang, or you were in certain branches of the military, and always non-commissioned. That was it. There was no other reason. So if you saw a tattoo, you immediately identified one of those three categories. Now, everybody has tattoos in California, which is a very bad sign, because what happens in California usually happens everywhere else. It used to be 20, 30 years later. Now, because of the texting era, it happens much faster. The trends that we're seeing in California are very disturbing. So the Muslim youth today represent, to me, an important barrier, in essence, between this collapse. It's like preventing a group of us, because the Quran talks about always a group of people. There should always be a group that represents this khayr, that calls to this good. And if that group is eliminated in a society, then there's no reason for that society to exist anymore, and either they perish or they're destroyed, one or the other. But this is what happens in human societies. They collapse, and societies do collapse. So the idea of being a torch bearer is very interesting, because light, carrying light and carrying fire, because fire is one of the foundational myths that we have of fire being really the beginning of human civilization. In fact, we have a character in Greek mythology that was punished by the gods for bringing fire to human beings. So this idea of fire is a really interesting concept, a torch bearer. One of the words in Arabic for fire is also the same, related to the same word for youth. Shabab, if you talk about fire when it really becomes inflamed, you say shabbat an-nar, that the fire entered into a shabab, right, state. So the shabab are the people with fire. They've got fire. But that fire, you see, the nature of fire is that it is the most beneficial element that we have out there after air, but it's also the most destructive. Fire is a very destructive element. So if you don't learn to control that fire, and this is what humans do with fire, they learn to control it, but fire can get out of control. And in that way, the fire of your youth is something that has to be controlled. Because if it gets out of control, it will either destroy you or it will destroy others. It can destroy families. Families are torn apart because of the fire of youth. Really, they're destroyed. And so it's really important that you recognize, I'm talking to the young people here, that you recognize that God has given you this fire. In fact, Fakhruddin al-Razi, in his tafsir, Mafatih al-Ghayb, mentions in the introduction that God put a fire so great in the heart of the human being that he had to put the lungs as a fanning system for the fire of the heart. And so he said that the lungs were actually a fanning system to keep the fire of the heart cooled. It cools. And that's why it's interesting that as we get hotter, we begin to breathe faster, right? Not to fan the flames, but actually to cool the fire, to cool it down. But the point that he made about this fire that God put in the hearts of human beings, he said that fire was to come to know God, that it's an energy in the human being that wants to know why he or she is here. And then once you know why you're here, how do you act? How do you behave? These are the great issues that our prophets came to talk about. And so, as you think about your role and your position here in the United States, I would argue that first and foremost, you should be exemplars. Exemplars of human dignity, because people recognize dignity. It's a very hard word to define, but it's something that when you see it, you recognize it. We are an ummah that was dignified in the way that we walked. Muslims walked in a dignified manner. The Prophet ﷺ had a very specific type of gait that's described. He had a gait that was a gait that indicated that he was a serious man. He wasn't somebody that meandered. He wasn't somebody that walked without intention. He walked as if he was on a declining slope. And it was hard to keep up with him because he was a very determined person. If he was called, he would stop. And he would give his whole body, because the Prophet ﷺ was a present human being. He was always present. He was never absent with people. If he looked or spoke to a person, he gave them their whole being. In fact, in the hadith, it said about his death that if anybody sends him a salam, Allah returns his soul to him, and he will return that salam to that person. Imam Asyuti said that what this means is that his intense istighraq in the barzakh, this complete drowning in the divine presence, is turned towards the creation. Because the Prophet, and that's the meaning of the radd ruh, the returning of the soul, because the Prophet's soul, it's not going back and forth like alive and dead. No, it means that he turns towards his creation in that moment. Now, if people say, you know, if people are doing that all the time, how is that possible? Like we're all saying, As-salatu was-salamu alayki ya Rasulullah. This is ma qadrullah haqqa qadrihi. This is people that have a worldly view of things. A worldly view of things. They're trapped in the dimensions of this realm that we're in, which is a very limited realm. It's called dunya. Once you leave the dunya, you enter into a completely different realm. Let me give you an example. We have computers today that monitor all of our phone calls. If you go to a bank and you swipe your card, they'll get approved or disapproved immediately. That same computer database is doing this for millions of transactions in every instant. This is a computer that a human being created. And so we don't have, you know, a Lord that can create a heart that can do all of that. The Prophet's heart can't do all of that. He can't be getting all those incoming messages and responding to them instantaneously. This is materialism. And people are trapped in materialism. We know that Omar radiallahu anhu, one of his miracles is that he used the first cell phone. He was in Medina and he was on the minbar and he said, Ya Sariyat al-Jabal. Saria was his commander in Persia, and they were in a battle, and they needed a place to take refuge to, and Omar shouted out on the minbar, Ya Sariyat al-Jabal, and then they turned and he heard the voice in Persia. This is a recorded miracle. People say, oh, you know, they don't believe in miracles anymore. The whole Islam is a miracle. This whole thing is a miracle. And there's miracles everywhere. You don't believe in miracles? This whole thing is a miracle. This is a miracle. How do I talk into these little things and my voice is heard all over the place? How is that possible? The whole thing's a miracle. And you can explain the whole technology to me, and it takes your voice and it amplifies the voice. You can explain all that to me. It doesn't diminish the miraculous nature of the world that we're in. There's miracles all over. You know, David Hume didn't have the ability to see that. That's his problem. It's not my problem. You know, really. We believe in miracles. وَثْبِتَنْ لِلْأَوْلِيَا الْكَرَامَ وَمَنْ نَفَاهَ فَنْبِذَنْ كَلَامَ This is our teaching. This was the aqidah of the Muslims. Assert the miracles of the saints, and anybody that rejects them, reject him. I believe in miracles. So the Prophet ﷺ, he came not only to teach us about otherworldly affairs, he came to teach us about worldly affairs. And at the center of this is the idea of dignity. The Prophet ﷺ was the most dignified of human beings. And anything that diminished his dignity or his muru'ah, he rejected it. This is why Imam Shafi'i said, radiallahu anhu, if I thought that drinking water would diminish my dignity one iota, I would have left drinking water. This is how concerned they were about dignity. So the Prophet ﷺ, he dressed in a dignified manner, and he encouraged people to dress in a dignified manner. We're living in a time of degraded dress. People literally look, first of all, they're wearing underwear in public. When I was a kid, t-shirts were considered underwear. That's how old I am, I don't have a problem with it. But I'm just letting you know, t-shirts were considered underwear. When I see people in a t-shirt, I see somebody in underwear. It's not the way that we should be encouraging our youth to dress. We now, you know, this the way the women are dressing today, لا حول ولا قوة إلا بالله العلي العظيم إن لله وإنا إليه راجعون. Even in the 1950s, it would have been considered outrageous. At the turn of the century, people would have heart attacks on the street. If you took somebody from the 19th century, Victorian England, and you put them, teletransported them through time, and put them out on a street in Washington, D.C. in 2012, they would literally either pass out or they would have a heart attack, because they could not believe that what they were seeing was actually happening, and that these people, they would assume immediately that they were primitive people, probably, like savages. And I liked what Tawakkul Nawal, the Yemeni, many of you saw her remark about wearing the hijab, the woman who won the Nobel Prize. When she was asked about her hijab, she said, I don't see this as a reactionary thing. On the contrary, I see it as an evolutionary thing. Because according to your sciences, we started out naked and we evolved into dress. And so the more naked people are, the less evolved they are. That was her argument, and I think that's a very solid argument. So you have to really think about dressing in a more dignified manner and not accepting this degraded culture. If you look at Muslims anywhere in human history, you look at the clothes that they wore, and you will see that they were dignified clothes. They always wore dignified clothes. And clothes are not insignificant. They're not insignificant. Our women, alhamdulillah, you see, one of the bizarre things about modern Muslims is you'll see this woman dressed in a traditional. In fact, a lady came up to me, a lady came up to me, we were in Turkey, and an American came up to me, she was the mother of a Muslim convert. And she said, it's so nice to see the Turkish men and women who dress in a congruous way. Like the women, Turkish women dress very, the Muslim women there who are modest, they dress in a very conservative, modest way, but it's very fashionable at the same time. So they look like they're part of the modern world, but they're also, they look like they're maintaining the tradition. Because you have something that needs to maintain but can be changed in its form, but its essence has to stay the same. So modesty is the essence. How you display that is that can be relegated to time and place. But she said, but what I find really strange is when I see these Muslim women dressed in their traditional garb, but with them are these Muslim men that look like they're comic book characters. Right? So you'll go there at Disney World, you know, you'll have some guy from a Muslim country, I won't say which ones, but you have some guy from a Muslim country, his wife, like, in a black garment, and he's there with a t-shirt, you know, that says something like, been there, done that. It just looks a little incongruous. Like, what's she doing in a black bag and you're wearing, you know, I'm with stupid, right? I mean, this is a problem. Like the absurdity of our modern age. So that's very important. Also, another aspect is food. Our Prophet ﷺ came to teach food. We should represent the best of our tradition. We should be eating less. We should not. If you look outside, people are turning into balloons. Really, they could get jobs advertising Goodyear blimps, you know, that advertise. Because they're so wide, they could have all of the corporate logos on one body. It's a bad sign when you have a culture that's turning into Goodyear blimps. I'm serious. It's a really serious problem in this country. In fact, one of these czars recently said, the greatest threat to America is no longer the Qaeda, it's the Big Mac. Because we're literally turning into the most obese nation on the planet. But it's not just here, because this food is being exported all over the world. So now you go to the Gulf states, and you've got over 40, 70% of these people now are being afflicted with diabetes. And diabetes is a disease of a civilization. It's not a natural disease. You shouldn't get type 2 diabetes. It's purely a disease of diet. It's what you're eating. It can be prevented, and it is controllable. I would recommend for you, I'm not espousing in any way a vegan diet, but I would recommend for you watching documentary called Forks Over Knives, or read the China study, or read Forks Over Knives, and see what they're doing now. The cutting edge doctors in this country, first and foremost, the cutting edge doctors are recommending for obese and diabetic people to walk 10,000 steps. That's about an umrah. If you do umrah, you'll find out it's about 10,000 steps. The human body is designed to work at its optimal level if it's walking every day at least 10,000 steps. You can get a little counter now and do that. People aren't well. They're not walking. We're all sitting behind computer terminals watching pixelated images and getting sicker and sicker. People need to exercise. There's a book that Imam Suyuti wrote called Al-Musara'atu ila al-Musara'a. And it's proving that it is a sunnah to actually wrestle, that wrestling was a sunnah of the Prophet ﷺ. He was a great wrestler. Rakana, he actually defeated the greatest wrestler. He was one of his cousins, distant cousin from Mecca. And he met him and he said, you're claiming to be a prophet, prove it to me. He said, what do you want me to do? He said, wrestle me. If you beat me, then I'll believe you. And he threw him down. And he got up immediately and he said, do that again. He couldn't believe it because nobody had ever thrown him. Sayyidina Ali was a great wrestler. Sayyidina Ali actually wrestled Yazid, the son of Muawiyah, and defeated him in a wrestling match. But that's an interesting little book, and Musara'atu ila al-Musara'a. arguing, we forget that it's a sunnah to exercise. The Prophet ﷺ, people are talking about sunnah, they grow their beards, they use their siwak, they do all these things, but they don't exercise. It is a sunnah to exercise. The Prophet exercised every single day because he was living in a society that demanded that you exercise, but he also said, إِنَّ لِجَسِدِكَ عَلَيْكَ حَقَّ. Your body has rights over you. Your body has rights over you. You should be eating what you need, about 1,700 to 2,200 calories, depending on your levels of activity. That can all be monitored. What you eat, you should be eating primarily foods that are good for you. Very little, you know, now, I mean, you go in Ramadan, the consumption levels are beyond belief. The waste levels are beyond belief. If you didn't lose weight this Ramadan, something's wrong with your fast. I'm serious. Something is wrong with your fast. People eat more in Ramadan than they do outside of Ramadan. Food, exercise. In the Olympics, if we participate in the Olympics, it's becoming really unbearable now, just the whole what's happened to the Olympics and things like that. But sports is an important element. I'm not anti-sports. But if we compete, we should be competing in those things that are particularly Muslim areas, like horseback riding. We need to reinvigorate horseback riding in our communities. Our youth should be riding horses. I grew up riding horses. It was one of the most beneficial things that I did as a child, because I was actually trained to ride. My sister still raises horses and has a horse ranch in Southern California. But you know, I grew up around horses. Horses are incredible creatures, beautiful creatures. The Prophet ﷺ loved horses. He loved horses. We should have horse camps for our youth in the United States of America, really, where they go out and interact with horses. Swimming. Get your youth swimming, but in halal environments, right? We have burkinis now. The women can swim too, you know. And don't ever be ashamed. I told my wife, she went swimming in Oman. I told her, look, don't be ashamed. They should be ashamed. You shouldn't ever be ashamed for covering up your nakedness. They should be ashamed, you know. So when Muslims wear those burkinis, there's nothing shameful about that. It's on the contrary, it's an honorable thing. It's the way people used to look. If you look at pictures of swimming women 100 years ago in this country, they're all wearing burkinis. It's a very American thing. Now, finally, just to dovetail and conclude with this, the single most important thing for our community is education. I confer wholeheartedly with what was said about the importance of being creative in your education. We have to be more creative as a community. Economics, for instance, what Dr. Ramadan mentioned earlier about economics. We study economics, all we do is study the mainstream economics and we mouth back what they teach us. They're now debating seriously the idea of getting back on a gold standard. This isn't a joke anymore. The number one activity now in terms of war games, you know, the Pentagon plays these war games. I read a book called Currency Wars, which argues that the last two wars and probably the Third World War will be over currency. But anyway, one of the things that he pointed out in that book is that the war games that they're playing now in the Pentagon are currency collapse scenarios. Like you saw what happened in Greece. If a currency collapses, societies fall apart. So they're actually very serious about this. And you have people in this country, Indiana has a sound money legislation about restoring gold because states can actually coin gold and silver. Our monetary system is based on gold and silver. Gold and silver is the monetary system of Islam. If gold was used today all over the world as the dominant form of wealth exchange, it would be about $20,000 an ounce. That's how much value it would have, right? But maybe gold's not the answer. That's open to debate in the modern world. I'm open to a debate. Prove to me a more superior system. But fiat money is problematic. Fractional reserve banking is completely un-Islamic because it's a fabricated wealth creation. And these things can be studied. And there are serious Western scholars. I read a book by a German economist called Non-Interest Economies. Kennedy, she's a Marguerite Kennedy in this book, arguing that interest is actually profoundly harmful to a society, to its economics and to its well-being. And she doesn't understand Islam, unfortunately. She makes some really silly remarks about Islam's views on usury. But there are intellectuals in this society that are actively arguing against usury-based forms of economics and many other areas. So we have to, and finally, my advice to myself and all of you, you have to, we're living in a time when there's a lot of mental disruption. People are not well. They're not well. We have people dyeing their hair orange and going in and shooting people. And these people, this guy was like, he was the best and the brightest of this culture. Like even the people at the university, he had a scholarship studying one of the most difficult subjects. And he was studying neuroscience, a PhD candidate. And he goes in and kills all of these people, one of the worst massacres in American history, with his hair dyed red because he watched a film, a Batman film. I mean, not because, you know, but that's part of the story. We have people that go in and literally imitate. I mean, I saw the footage of this guy that went into Mendocino School and killed people, and he was literally imitating Arnold Schwarzenegger. And apparently he'd watched one of his movies over and over and over again. Plato said, if you want to corrupt youth, if you want to corrupt them, the most efficient way to corrupt youth is by using corrupting stories. Corrupting stories. This is why he actually argues, or Socrates, to censor the types of stories that are told in cultures. Most of what's on television is arguably haram to be watching. Most of it, arguably. The ulama, I really want to reassess a lot of the image-based fatwas of the late 19th century and look at what the ulama were talking about, because I think the whole image-based culture is becoming a serious problem. This whole idea of everybody can take pictures. This is my image. Like, who gave you the right to take my picture? Seriously, and then paste it up on Facebook. Who gave you that right? Did you ask me my permission? Hey, can I take your picture, your image? Can I take your image and then put it up on Facebook for anybody to see with my mouth wide open or while I'm eating something or, you know, or whatever, or, you know. Did I give you that right? Seriously, because people didn't just go around taking pictures of other people. This is some modern thing that's happened. If you watch 19th century, just look at some of the photographs. They're always like this. You know why they're like that? Because they were in awe of the idea of their image being permanently produced. And they're always dressed in their best clothes. They didn't just go in their t-shirts, been there, done that. I'm with stupid. Or rabbit ears behind somebody. You don't see any 19th century guys with rabbit ears behind his wife or something like that, right? Because they weren't idiotic people. They were actually dignified people that had a sense of human dignity. So, you know, I really think we should reassess what some of those early scholars said about that. And, you know, because I really question the validity of all this image-based culture. I think it's very dangerous. I read Neil Postman's book, Amusing Ourselves to Death, and I think his argument, I think it's the second chapter about the Decalogue's prohibition on graven images, his argument is pretty solid and very Islamic as far as I'm concerned. Anyway, God bless all of you. May Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala increase all of our youth, give you strength, preserve you, make you dignified people, people that are torchbearers of the light of Islam. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.